welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday Special. This morning I'm joined by Tony Groves, I'm joined by Sharon Lambert, and I'm joined by Maria Delaney. We're looking forward to another great show this week. It's like not like we haven't had a quiet week. There's an awful lot going on in politics. So I think I'll come to Maria first. Maria, would you tell us about that story you had during the week? And it's a really, really shocking, shocking story. Will you fill us in on the details, please?
Thanks, Martin. Yeah, so this story, like, it's not a news story, but it hasn't really been covered massively by the Irish media. I first came across it in 2014. So it's the Valparaiso scandal. And basically, it's a medicine for epilepsy. It's called Epilum, the branded name in Ireland. And women weren't told for decades. Like, it didn't go on for just years, for decades, about the side effects in terms of pregnancy. So if taken during pregnancy, it has a really high incidence of congenital problems and also developmental delay, and results in severe disability for a lot of children of women who are on this drug. But doctors failed to tell the women of these side effects and these congenital issues, even though they were known actually from the licensing that it could have this effect. So it's been an international scandal, and in other countries like the UK and France, there have been inquiries and court cases and compensation recommended for victims, and also schemes in place for the children that are affected, such as access to medical care and not having to pay for medical care and things like that. But in Ireland, it kind of has gone under the radar, even though the government have known about it for a long time. And I suppose my investigation looked into what was being done for the victims and their families or the survivors. And also there was a promised inquiry last November. So what's happening with that? So that's, and basically we found that there is almost no support in place for survivors and their children. And the inquiry still hasn't a time frame, even though Minister Donnelly promised a fast inquiry back in November. So that's, I suppose, the main findings. And I suppose more worryingly as well, some of the key recommendations to prevent this continuing to happen, for children continuing to be born with these developmental delays and congenital issues, aren't actually being put in place. So that's, I suppose, one thing, that this scandal can actually be continuing to happen as women are being missed and not being warned of these issues.
You say doctors have known for a long time, Maria. Any idea what the time frame on that is?
Yeah, so this drug was actually, it was developed in the 60s. And since its development, like, studies during its development actually showed tetrogenic, so that's effects of babies in the womb in mice. So it was known that this could actually happen in humans when it was put on the market. And it is, I suppose, just to say, it is a very important drug for epilepsy and for other groups, I suppose, that aren't women of childbearing age. So that's one thing to say. So don't just come off the drug if you're on it, because that can be very dangerous. But back in the 1970s, these effects were known when it came on the market in Ireland, yet people weren't warned about it. And then I suppose more and more reports came out that this was happening in people rather than just mice. And then in the 80s, developmental delays were started to be reported as well. And yet, like, women still weren't told about it. Like, they still weren't informed. Like, I've talked to countless women at this stage that only found out about it after reading my reports. So I've reported on it a few times over the years, yet it's a huge issue. And I suppose that's, I suppose, one key thing about, because some people were comparing it to, say, vaccines at the moment. Like, the difference is that these, like, say, the side effect of the blood clots, like, we all know about it. We've been told about it. This was like, if they knew about it and they just didn't tell us and they kept giving the drug. So that's kind of the difference between what happened with this and what happened, like, say, I suppose, people comparing it to vaccines. This isn't the same at all.
And is there any rationale to why they didn't tell people? Is there a reason why they weren't told?
Well, I suppose if you're looking at it in the context, like, this impacted women and children. And like, it's another scandal that people, like, that women, I suppose, were dismissed, were undermined, and just weren't told about something. And like, there was a report in the UK, and it found that, sorry, I'm just going to look up what exactly it said, but it was basically the UK regulators decided not to warn patients. This was in 1973, so you can see how long ago this was, because it could give rise to fruitless anxiety. And I suppose like that's kind of a classic of the attitude of kind of the medical profession maybe at that time. But it's more, the thing is that was the 1970s, it happened in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, like the woman that was Debbie Adams, who was at the start of my feature, like her children were born like 9 years ago. Like it's not something that is that ancient, if you know what I mean. It was still happening up to recently, and maybe actually could be still happening now because the measures haven't been put in place to prevent it happening.
It just on the numbers, it's in your report, the HSE report estimates between 153 and 341 children will have experienced a major congenital malformation, and up to 1,250 children will have experienced neurodevelopment delays from exposure to valproate. I saw someone refer to it on your thread on social media as a thalidomide type scandal that hasn't gotten the exposure. You're right in saying that it's known. You know, there are people in the audience who I know whose family have spoken about it previously. So you know, I'm aware that this has been going on for decades. It just doesn't seem to have got the public attention. And now that it's resurfaced, now have you found? Are we able to put any political pressure on Minister Donnelly to bring this inquiry forward, because he's promised it and then he immediately put it on the back burner?
Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, Tony, I've been trying to get this out there, I suppose, as a journalist since 2014 when I first found out about it. So I spoke to Karen Keeley. So she's from Oaks, Ireland, and is an unbelievable advocate for this. But like, she's doing it in a voluntary capacity, like so are all the other women affected, and they probably have conditions themselves like epilepsy and children with severe disabilities. So it's really hard for them. But I've actually been shocked at the lack of appetite for this. Like, it's a huge scandal, and yet like every time I write about it, people, even in power, like TDs I've spoken to, haven't heard about it. And like, I have had some feedback from TDs after I wrote the article this week saying they're hoping to bring it up in the Dáil. But it's just unbelievable that I'm just shocked every time I write about it how many people haven't heard about it even still.
And there's been you said there's been cases in other jurisdictions. Have they won their cases in other jurisdictions?
Yeah, so there has been, like in France in particular, like survivors have won cases where they are getting compensation now from the government. They brought cases against Sanofi, which is the company that currently has the license for the drug. So they took over the original company that owned the drug or that developed the drug. And then in the UK, I suppose the most critical thing recently was in the UK, a report called First Do No Harm. So it looked at this as well as some other issues that affected women, such as the mesh, which also affects a lot of people, like the vaginal mesh affects a lot of people in Ireland as well. But this, I suppose it was a huge report for valproate survivors and their families, because it showed how women had been dismissed. And it also showed how they found the system there is not safe enough for those taking medications in pregnancy. So that was a current statement, like that it's still, and they recommended like improvements for systems in the UK. And when I was talking to people for this particular investigation, they were saying it's exactly the same in Ireland. Like the likelihood of finding anything different happening in Ireland was extremely unlikely. And doctors did, some of the experts I was talking to saying where doctors did not tell women about this, or they didn't know about it, so they didn't. So I suppose both of those things are equally bad, that doctors didn't know about the impacts on pregnancy or they didn't tell people. So like, I suppose that's what we're expecting from the inquiry. But I know that like some of the survivors I've spoken to, like they really want answers, like they want the government to look at what the regulator did. Like, they had meetings with the company who developed it. Did the company tell them? Did the regulator know and does not spread the word to doctors? So I suppose it's you're looking at both the historical aspect of what happened, but also like what's happening for families now, which is very little.
Are there any cases pending in Ireland?
Not that I know of. I think most of the survivors, not that I, like I've spoken to a lot of survivors on this and I haven't heard of any court cases pending, but I suppose the survivors are really hoping that they'll get answers from the inquiry. And I suppose like in the UK, that there will be recommended of a redress scheme. So that has been recommended in the UK, and also supports put in place. And they have been promised supports without an inquiry, such as a report I have seen that hasn't been released yet, but recommending that all patients with fetal valproate syndrome, which is the syndrome that children can get, should be given a medical card. Families are also calling for the families to get a medical card, but I suppose it's just basic services that they need, like speech therapy, physiotherapy, psychology. Like, it's all these things that, like, you, like, these children have been harmed, and they're still, like, their families are paying thousands for these services out of their own pocket. So I think that's I suppose it's a mixture of looking at what happened and also like looking at the lack of services in place for families.
There, I'm going to move us on. Maria, thank you very much for coming on and having this chat with us.
I think if you can hang on for a few minutes, some of the stuff wraps into this, because I just want to very quickly and move on really quickly to the announcement on KBC pulling out. It won't take me a minute. As someone who's actually worked in KBC and in Ulster Bank and in Bank of Ireland and for basically every permanent TSB, you name them, it's terrifying to watch it just shrink away to what it is. It's terrifying realizing that they're pulling the plug. They're being divided up. The loan books are being sold off. And we already have the most uncompetitive banking industry in the EU. We have the highest mortgage rates still. We have banks that are effectively state-owned now. An entire permanent TSB, as people probably are aware, failed its sustainability test with the EU, with ECB, as you know, in terms of its balance sheet, that's pretty much state-owned bank. AIB is still dominantly 78%, I think, state-owned. Bank of Ireland has the state only hold 14%, but we all know that there was other deals that were done with Bank of Ireland in terms of private capital that went on. Where it leaves the consumers in an awful position, and where it leaves the state is in an opportunity has been missed year after year after year to establish what would be a state bank acting as a baseline and a driver of things. And it was doable. I know there's been opposition have put bills forward, the likes of Piers Doherty, and that have put forward proposals, none of which has floated, because we've had ministers for finance who have said they don't want to interfere in the market. Well, at this stage, the real problem is going to be the lack of competition means that it is basically a duopoly or an oligopoly, and that is a big concern.
Can we go for a state bank now, Tony? Is it too late?
No, we have to. Of course, we own like permanent TSB. We just have to understand what if we change its direction. How do we do it? How do we, you know, what is the ethos of the bank there? Because for years we've put money into the bank on the idea that it would start to return to profit and become a lender in the commercial sense. So it's about changing that focus. All of that is still on the table. Like, the opportunity is still there. But I don't know. It's not that I don't know. No political will to do it, Mark.
What are the effects for people who are now going for mortgages? And
never mind mortgages. Simply put, like, coming out for just your current account needs, your basic needs are very restricted now. All of those options that were on the table are going to get more and more limited. Fees are going to go up because, you know, they act in unison. Like, it was always the case with Bank of Ireland and AIB that if they added 20, if it was 20 cent to use an ATM and one of them went to 22 cent to use an ATM, that just gave them license to almost move. We've seen it where, you know, the European Commission came in and saw these practices were happening in car insurance, for example, that they would move in an oligopolistic fashion. That's what we face now. that sort of idea that they could do that in tandem, because they simply know that if I move, you move. It's the same with, think Aldi and Lidl, you know, competing deals on the same sort of, on the same product lines, and away you go. But they're not drive. This isn't to drive competition, because they've captured the market in effect. I think, look, we've gone too long on this. I just wanted to raise it. It's hard to get people within the banks to talk about it. It's easy to get industry correspondents, but it's hard to get people within the banks to talk about it. I've spoken to former colleagues in places, and they are concerned because the jobs themselves, it's not like, you know, there's going to be places for people to land when there's less places to go.
Going to stop just there for a minute, Tony. It's time to do a plug, and we have to do plugs. There's a reason behind this.
Yeah, no, no one likes having to do plugs. I get really embarrassed about it, because I hate having to say to people that this doesn't come along. This doesn't just materialize out of the sky. It needs to be supported. I mean, you used the phrase last week. If you want change, invest in it. I mean, it is really that simple. A few people have actually helped us out. You know, there's been a couple of people chipping in. And I do want to say just we really appreciate it. There are tiers when you go into patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There are tiers. You get different things for different prices, naturally enough. But if you just want, how do I put this? The consolidated.
The basic. Yeah.
Yeah,
you're the full package.
Every podcast that we put out goes out on one RSS feed that you get for yourself for $5.50 a month. With that, you also get access to the Sunday shows, which are doing gangbusters, and some lots of other live shows that go on during midweek. So, like, for example, Reboot 100 a couple of weeks ago, that was just an epic 2.5 hour podcast that you'll never get out on Main, by the way. I'm not being bad, but simply we might break it up and put some parts of it out, but you're not going to be able to get that sort of live show experience again.
Looking forward, Tony, like, we'll be coming out of this, hopefully, this lockdown pandemic thing very shortly, and we'll be back doing live shows, and patrons get first preference on tickets, on everything.
Yeah. So, and there's discount codes, and there's all sorts of stuff. We're trying to do our best to try and make ourselves sound professional. It's not that easy, I can tell you. But, like, I suppose one thing that happened this week, Martin, that is interesting, is we have another podcast launching soon. We have other people who actually, they have to develop them, guys. It's not just a case of, I want to do a podcast, plug it in here. You know, there's equipment to be purchased because everybody's working remotely. You got to work this out. There's two hosts involved, so that's two sets of kit, all that sort of stuff.
A huge amount of time.
I know, absolutely. But one of the freelancers who I engage with actually sent me a message straight away and said, thanks so much for paying. Because we just, invoice was sent and they were paid. And I just thought, isn't that just so telling that they were?
We don't stiff anybody with the
It takes
a village to put out a podcast, to be really honest about it, Tony.
It takes people to support us, because the simple fact is the money that goes in goes back out, and hopefully it gives opportunities to other people to share their stories. That's the main thing. That's the reason we do it.
And it's real simple to do. Look, just patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's that simple. Just do it.
I've spoken to former colleagues in places, and they are concerned because the jobs themselves, it's not like, you know, there's going to be places for people to land when there's less places to go. That's going to be more difficult.
Okay. I'm going to move us on a little to vaccines for 29 to 30 year olds. Now, whilst that suits me, it may not suit everybody. Maria, any thoughts on vaccines for 29 to 30 year olds?
Yeah, I can see, I suppose, if you read research, it's vaccinate the older people to reduce the death rates, vaccinate the younger people to reduce the transmission. But I think this is a very contentious issue. And I suppose we'll have to see what NIAC say, because their thing all along was to vaccinate the most at risk, I suppose, and that's why they went by age. And I think if they change stance on that now to the transmission, and they haven't looked at groups, I suppose there's a huge call from SNAs that you can see, and teachers and people, I suppose, in contact with people, especially children with no masks on, I suppose, at the moment. I think there will be a lot of backlash on that. It's kind of, I suppose, vaccinating people because they're behaving riskily, which is not, I suppose, the most ideal scenario. So, yeah, I think we'll have to see what NIAC say. It's just a theory at the moment. It's just kind of something that
I think it's something
has been looked into. Yeah, exactly.
It was a kite that was flown, and I don't think it got any traction.
Yeah, like, to be honest, I think sometimes the government or people within the government put out these ideas to see what the reaction is going to be, and then when the reaction is bad, then they're like, "Oh, it was just a thought."
I'm even more cynical. I think sometimes they put out stories like these, knowing they'll create a little furor, but it detracts from some other story. I'm more saying, but the basic line is vaccinate everybody, just get enough vaccines and vaccinate everybody, and then we won't have this horse and pony show really and truly about vaccines.
The only thing I will say on it, and like I see Jana Lyons is in the audience, she'll know better about the how infuriating it must be as an educator, that, you know, you were told you were going to be in this cohort, then you were told, look, we're going on an age-based thing, and then you're told, as Maria quite rightly points out, well, the 20 to 30 year olds might be a little less responsible, so we'll get them done first. It might make sense. And it was all contradiction on top of contradiction, in effect. And it was a strange way to do things. It'll be interesting. I mean, we've seen a huge backlash within government to their own policies. Like, has anybody ever seen anything as the government reacting to their own policy of mandatory hotel quarantine?
No, it's very confusing for people on the outside to see a government line attacked by government representatives. I don't think we've seen it, you know, in the past in a small way as a kind of a constituency advantage thing, but never on a national platform. And they're doing it on a national platform, undermining their own government's decisions. I mean, I have to point out that Regina Doherty is now in the Fingal area and is actively campaigning against mandatory hotel quarantine because she's looking for the airport vote. And it's that cynical. It's utterly cynical.
Well, I mean, that's very clear, because she's actually using the bloody Save Aviation hashtags on things.
Well, that and she's wearing a Ryanair uniform. You know, it's undermining the message across the board to be undermining the government's own message, to have them undermining it. And it makes them look weak, really, really weak, to have their own people undermining it. I really do think so.
Just One thing that kind of wraps into what you were saying, Martin, is the story of deflecting from other stories. And we see, again, civil servants pay rises, and then we see a big data dump from Ken Fox in terms of money that's gone into special advisors and external advisors, which was quite interesting, because what was interesting was the people, I mean, one particular person became the focus of it, an influencer or whatever the phrase you want to use, and that they became the focus. I thought that was, yeah, that's fair enough. That makes a good headline. It makes good reading. But some of the ones that I've gone through the list, it's like 11 pages long of TDs and ministers and ministers of state and junior ministers and all of these people who are paying people to provide. That they're writing bits for them, they're giving them media advice and giving them all of this. Some of the people were quite scary. Like, there was one person really high up in an environmental NGO at one stage, Martin, who was advising no one less than the Taoiseach.
Everybody's entitled to work. I mean, everybody's entitled to work. But the fact is, if you're going to be writing government pieces that are pro-government or pro-particular politician, you should really be saying that straight up. You know, full disclosure, if that's what you're doing, disclose what you're doing.
I don't know if that's fair. Like, but I just want to point out one, as I said, €27,748 to one individual who, from the Taoiseach's office, and as I said, with links to, you know, environmental NGOs, and you just think this is a strange thing to do when people are campaigning on one side and you have other people pushing back on others. Mate, the workers, get that money, get your money, boys and girls. You have to get paid. You have to pay your mortgage or whatever it is. But it's quite extraordinary that the level of, like, I mean, that's a lot of money. That's not like a couple of grand for a bit of advice on something. And, you know, it's quite comprehensive that And like this, and the other thing I disagree, Martin, at least when it is FOI'd, it can all be in the public domain. But that doesn't mean that we all get to the idea that we can all unpack it. You know, maybe the piece has already gone out, maybe the statement's already been made, and we don't know, you know, what it was.
Yeah,
done.
You have to go back retrospectively and have a look and see what the story. Maria, where do you stand on writing pieces for ministers or for what should we say for PR purposes?
Yeah, like I think you have to be very careful if you're part of an NGO like or a lobbying group, like to then go, I suppose it would be like, say if it, I suppose use the example of a journalist, like if a journalist like myself was writing for like Noteworthy, where we're doing investigations and then also doing PR for government agencies that maybe that they're writing about, like I would always find that to be a conflict of interest. But again, you'd have to be very careful as an NGO as well. And I know what you're saying, like people get money and people are environmental advisors. It is complicated when maybe you're the only specialist in a field or that kind of thing. But in the journalism sphere, like that wouldn't be looked on very well, I don't think. So that's, I suppose, where I'd stand on it. But it's probably slightly more complicated but if you're lobbying the government for something and then also working for them, like it is kind of a situation you have to be very careful of, I think.
Yeah, and it just encourages that distrust people have. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but another former TD yesterday announced that he'd launched a new consultancy company. Me being me, I went immediately into the lobbying register and I said, oh, there it is on the lobbying register, you know, because this idea of like, if you call yourself a consultant, it's what you mean is you're actually going to be a lobbyist for private corporate interests. And why you're doing that is because you're buying access and influence because of your previous role in politics. And, you know, that's all well and good, but you know, the lobbying register is really effective, by the way, if you use it, but the majority of people just see, you know, Jazz Hands Consultancy and go, that sounds good. It's not Jazz Hands Consultancy. The job is to like one of the things I saw lobbying was on behalf of the drone industry. And I thought that was quite funny. You know, this is where we're going now. The drone industry is now lobbying inside Leinster House.
Sharon, I see you're back with us now. Are you? No, I don't think so.
But I suppose just in terms of lobbying, sorry, Martin, I suppose that's one thing that, like, say, what influence do former politicians have? Like, I think that's something that definitely needs to be looked at. I suppose just give it throw out, but like, Noteworthy's actually hoping to look into that issue. That's one of our proposed investigations.
It's one of your big ones, and people can go on and fund on, go on to Noteworthy, and just if it's a specific story you want to fund, go ahead and fund that one. Or if it's just a generic chip in with a few quid, do chip in with a few quid because that's what
I only said to Tony, I think it was yesterday, I'm so looking forward to that one when it comes out. I think it's going to be huge to see the connections between lobbyists and politicians and to see what the revolving door looks like. So I'm really looking forward to that one. Absolutely dying to read it.
Can I just? We were due to be joined by Caroline Otham from the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, but she's in Nairobi in Kenya, and she's having problems with her line as well. So we're all struggling with Wi-Fi today. The reason we were going to talk about it is because yet again Ireland has been flagged as a misbehaving in terms of what the Global Tax Alliance call tax abuse. And we've seen, you know, for example, the most recent one of Google putting nearly, I think it's 73 billion funds beyond the reach of sovereign nations in terms of taxation. And that is a great difficulty. And it's something that is, we're going to have to start paying a price for it. And we're already paying a price for it. Just to remind people that when it came to the COVID recovery fund, Ireland was hands were tied because our economy did so well off the back of our multinational tax receipts that we couldn't actually avail of the money that was coming out. It's been pointed out that there's several economists who have gone to bat for the state on this, and that is fine. I like they're entitled to. Like the former head of the Fiscal Advisory Council is going to talk as the former head of the Fiscal Advisory Council. No one is going to be shocked at that. But my reply back to someone like Seamus Coffey is, there's a reason why the Global Alliance for Tax Justice have been nominated for the Nobel Prize, because it's been identified as a huge issue for the world. It's not just because I have a spreadsheet that shows us that it's not, that it's okay, that, you know, we're not an outlier. That doesn't make it true. I think it's 8 countries make up 85% of total tax avoidance in the world, and Ireland is one of the top 8. So
yeah, it is. And when you look at the services that are missing, particularly in healthcare, where we've seen acute shortages in healthcare, you've got to say to yourself, what are we doing in this country? Are we doing?
But no, hang on, that's not true, because the reality is that money quite often isn't our money. We've just helped facilitate it from other sovereign nations. So it's taking, that's why we're talking to Caroline in Nairobi. She's able to tell you, like, in terms of medics and doctors that they're missing in the Kenyan health service because of funds that have been channeled through certain other countries that do that and then take money off the top. So that's the real issue.
We're kind of like a subcontractor who's going in and saying, pay us the absolute lowest you can pay us and we will do this for you. I mean, it's not good business. It's not good business sense.
Well, I don't know. Maybe the other people disagree and say it is good business sense when the economy was okay during COVID, during a global pandemic. But then so there's the economy and then there's the real economy.
There's two different economies, Tony, and GDPR, as has been said, is leprechaun economics.
Why are you talking about GDPR now? You're going to data protection. You mean GDP.
Sorry, GDP. Look. It is. It's gone to crazy. You know, it is crazy. And I'm just going to move us on to another story that it's been reported in the newspapers, in the Sunday Business Post this morning, that top civil servants are in line for a pay rise of up to 40K next year, which would bring their earnings up and above 250,000. Now, I don't know, am I the only one who thinks this is utterly insane, and that instead of a low pay commission, what we should really have in this country is a differential commission? To look at the differences between what people on social welfare are getting paid and what top civil servants are getting paid, because they're both coming from the same purse. Tony, any thoughts on it?
I'm going to disagree with you. I just have to, like, I hate the pitting private versus public conversation that we seem to focus on.
But this is all public. This is public servants and people on who have to
claim. I get that, but I wonder how many people are we talking about here, Martin? Are we talking about a handful of people? Are we talking about?
Well, you're talking secretary generals, maybe one step below. But
hang on. You framed it in such a way as we have to have an idea that, okay, 40,000 sounds exorbitant, and I don't agree with necessarily these big salaries being paid, but I also have to put caveat that where you have people in the lower ranks of the civil service who might get a pay rise who probably, you know, have are well worth the money that they're being paid, and we need to caveat that with everything else. Like, I mean, we're going to pick on them, yet we can turn around and say, if you're in a global multinational in Ireland and you're availing of the SARF fund, you're paying 20% tax. I mean, there's all sorts of other deals done everywhere.
There is, but the one that we can control, the one that we can put a noose on and say, no, this has gone too far, is what civil servants are paid. That's within our remit. I can't tell Google not to pay.
First of all, it is within our remit because the state keeps renewing this sweetheart tax deal for their high paid professionals. But then the second part on that is, you know, the TDs and politicians already got, was it, Maria, you might correct me, was it 4 pay rises in the last 18 months or something phenomenal like that?
Yeah, I think the issue here is, I suppose, I think the timing of it. Like, it's 19 secretary generals, so it's not a huge amount of people, but it's more the timing of these things. Like, I suppose, like, most people I've been talking to over the last few months have been on either pay cuts last year, or their pay has been stopped. And like, I started working in the last recession where all of my friends either had to emigrate or we had no pay rises for around a decade. And then we're coming into this with kind of, again, no pay rises and or pay cuts or time cuts where people are working half time or less than that. And I know a lot of people now are back maybe on full time again, but like almost everyone who's gone through salary reviews and stuff over, say, in January or December, were told, no, like, you can't have any pay rise due to COVID, even if their business maybe wasn't hugely impacted by COVID, though I know most were. So I suppose it's coming on the back of that. So it doesn't really look good for the government or kind of civil servants, I suppose, that are, to most people, extremely highly paid, maybe not highly paid compared to some of the private sector. But yeah, I suppose that would be my point of view on it, that you have to look at the overall picture in the country when you're talking about these pay rises.
Sharon, did you manage to find us? I don't think so. I don't think Sharon has managed to come back in. I see what you're saying, Maria, but I definitely think that when it's coming from the state purse, when it's coming from taxpayers, that we should have some input. We have a low pay commission that is falling apart because they can't agree on what a low wage is. Now, we must be able to agree on what a high wage is. And it's the differential between the two. We are the most unequal society or equal society in the EU. I mean, the differences in income is enormous.
Our income inequality is, I think, second worst in the OECD.
Yeah, it's like enormous. If you can't tackle it at the level where it's the state paying people, then how do you have any hope of ever tackling it? And it's a vicious circle. You pay top civil servants more, then people in the private sector say, look at their package, we need to be paid more, and it's on and it grows and grows.
Can I say one thing that sort of plays into this a little bit? Seems to be a good deal done in the INMO with the public health facilities now, and I saw even Niall Conroy in Australia commenting that he didn't think this was going to happen for years, and here we are on the cusp of a deal where we might actually have public health treated in the way it deserves to be treated. You know, like, you have great public health doctors who should be public health consultants, and you know, and there's going to be some parity of there. So, you know, we give a lot of grief on this podcast. It's good to see something that is actually a positive that may be coming out down the pipeline. Don't want to sing a song to Stephen Donnelly or anything, but I still say if he gets it over the line, and I think is it McGrath's involved as well? Excuse me, I could be wrong, but fair play if they get this over the line, it's a really good positive initiative.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we have seen during this pandemic that a lot of things that we were told could not be done can actually be done. And I think we have to look at wage inequality in that as well. I think we certainly have to.
Well, I mean, I think people have pointed out the two-tier economy that we've had has been exacerbated actually following the global financial crisis. And then we've seen statistics show we've had the highest transfer of wealth in the history of since we started measuring markets in 2020. I mean, that's crazy. In the middle of a global pandemic, the rich got wealthier at a faster rate than they ever had before. So there's something strange there. Sharon, I know you've tried. I really appreciate you trying over and over. But I think if we can't get you there on that, we might just move it on, Martin, and ask people if they will have any questions or.
Yeah, has anybody any questions there or anything they'd like to come in with? Please raise your hand and we'll get to them. Just to while we're waiting for people to raise their hands, Tony, the notion that house prices are back to where they were during the Celtic Tiger, that came up during the week. That was something else as well.
No one should really be surprised. It was like, okay, two things that really caught my eye this week is that people were saying they were surprised by that when in fact foreign capital has been invited in here since the global financial crisis, and it has absolutely swollen the coffers of certain managed funds, real estate investment trusts, and they can set a good floor for everybody. The other thing that I thought was funny yesterday was people losing their minds about the fact that the Double Irish hasn't been closed, even though it was never closed. They said, we are phasing it out. So that was quite funny that people were going, oh, I can't believe that's been done. That was always the case. They gave the companies enough time to set up other facilities to do it, where the game has moved on. You know, there was the Double Irish with a Dutch sandwich. Now they're all moving their own intellectual property and borrowing. You know, you have Monster Energy setting up Monster Energy IP and selling their IP to a different brass plate over there, and then taking a loan out to purchase that, and then charging themselves interest. And then all of a sudden, Ireland's like going, hang on, what was that 35 billion for? Yeah, no, don't worry, it's nothing to do with you guys. And it's totally legal, Martin.
I see somebody has raised an issue there about Leo Varadkar being in the newspapers today. Maria, any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, so this is to do with the consultant contracts. Yeah, so he's he has been questioned by the guards. So that's, yeah. I haven't been covering this story, so I don't really want to have too many comments. But yeah, I suppose everyone knew that was coming. I suppose that he was going to be
interviewed under caution is all we've got. And we've got a little bit of comment on that. They still don't anticipate the DPP, which, you know, that's comment. It's not fair. Gabriel Colleran has said that it was ignored for 17 years in terms of the public health contract, and that, you know, fair play to Stephen Donnelly and the guys for rallying around. I think it is very, very important. And I think you're dead right to point it out. I'm going to bring in Oisin because I'm sure he'll have a comment for you, Maria, because he's familiar with the scandal that we opened the podcast with. Oisin, how are you?
Hiya, not too bad, Tony and Maria. Great job on the story. I was just going to say, you were saying you were surprised at how hard it has been for the story to take. And I think, unfortunately, that reflects Ireland's stories around maternal health has been persistently terrible, like, over the decades. I still am amazed at the fact that I don't know how many people still these days are aware of Michael Neary, a man who was conducting hysterectomies just because he basically felt like it. And he never even got criminally prosecuted, you know. And we have in Ireland a country where the standard of care that gets judged by in terms of medical malpractice is based on a famous case taken against the National Maternity Hospital in the 80s, the Dunn case. And they're now referred to as the Dunn principles. And I can understand your frustration is what I'm saying. I think Ireland has been consistently terrible. Like, we're horrible about health anyway. But this, when it comes to maternal health, when it comes to anything to do with pregnancy and babies, forget it. Just absolutely forget it. And the list is as long as your arm, whether it's the Kerry babies or it's Neary or, you know, the string of women dying during the 80s. It's all of a piece. And I guess the one thing I always want to remind people here is Ireland is, like, we used to be considered the leaders of obstetric thinking because we were the first country to ever have a lying-in ward in the Rotunda Hospital, you know? I don't know how we ever get past that. And it's some measure of shame that we can campaign as hard as we can on repeal the eighth, but we don't address a lot of the related issues in terms of reproductive rights.
Maria, any comment on that one?
Yeah, like, I suppose, like, Oisin is totally right. Like, I say I'm always shocked by it, but then I shouldn't be shocked by it. Like, if you look at our history, I suppose, yeah, it's like anything. If you know, like you're saying, like, it's things that affect women, and especially to do with pregnancy or maternity care, it does seem to just be treated badly here, but also, like, it's reflected across the world. Like, it's not just Ireland. Like, if you look at, there's been studies in pain medication for doctors, and it's been shown that, like, women aren't listened to when they're telling doctors they're in pain. And, like, in America, it was shown that minorities, especially Black women, are even listened to less. So it just shows that it is systemic across the world. And I shouldn't be surprised. I suppose it's just when you are so familiar with something, it's always like shocking when people just don't seem to care. But then, like, as you're saying, it does seem to be a systemic issue, unfortunately. But hopefully it going forward, it'll stop. But these things keep happening, unfortunately. The main thing is to try and highlight them and show what happened and try and get survivor stories out there so that people know that these things are happening. And I suppose I was shocked that it's maybe people aren't familiar with it. It's more, I suppose, I've been trying to cover the story or get it out there. And it's even like, I find it even hard to maybe get stories on it or publish and things like that back when I was a freelancer. So I think my editor, Susan Daly, was really supportive of me doing this investigation, and she really wanted me to do it, to the point where it was actually only part funded. So we're a crowdfunded platform, and we filled the rest of the funding in with our general fund because we knew this story had to be put out there. But I suppose that just shows we couldn't even get it funded. There just didn't seem to be a huge appetite, I suppose, in terms of women's stories, like you're saying, or things that affect maternity care. And we need to change that as a country. It's what I would think anyway.
I think we'd all be in agreement with that, Maria. I think it's gone on long enough. We're going to close out this recording part of this,
We're going to close the whole thing if no one else has any questions, because there was a few good comments, but has anybody else got any questions and we can let people get on with their day? And I'm really sorry that we had such a failure with it's not. And Sharon, thanks for sticking with us and trying to get through. Oh, and Caroline got her Invisalign in, so she wasn't able to speak to do the podcast. And happy birthday to Glenn Fitzpatrick. So we had to get that in
what
as well.
What age is Glenn? 12, 13?
Now.
Yeah. he's definitely a handsome chap, whatever age he is. But he doesn't look an old guy, and he does not.
29 and three quarters.
I knew it. So he'll get the vaccine. Well, good for you, Glenn.
We leave it there.
We will. We'll close it out there. Folks, thank you very much for coming along. Anybody, any more comments? We might look at them just after this. And thanks for coming. Look, spread the word to everybody else. We like doing this show on a Sunday. We get a good listenership. So just tell your friends. Come along on Sunday and have a listen. Thanks, everybody.